My name is Sarah Tullock, Talking Writing's podcast production manager, and this is the Talking Writing Podcast. Please enjoy the episode.
Steve Hoffman is an award-winning food writer who resides in Minnesota. He's been published in Food and Wine, The Washington Post, the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and some other publications. And his first book was released this past July. The book is titled A Season for That, Lost and Found in the Other Southern France. Do you want to just give our listeners just a quick kind of introduction or summary of your book? Just so they
have the book?
Context.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So it is a memoir. It is the story of our Minnesota family's extended fall semester from July through January of 2012 in a 800-person tiny winemaking village in the Languedoc region of southern France. And so it's, I'm a food writer. Most of my writing has been food writing. So it's a story about our trying to immerse ourselves into that place. It's also the story of my sort of self-education in Mediterranean food and cooking. It's the story eventually of my becoming kind of deeply immersed in the agricultural kind of blue collar end of winemaking in that region, because it was the way to become a part of the place. And it's all, but it's also a very much a family story. It's a story of being a part of a 35, or at the time, 23-year, now 35-year marriage of equals. And the story of a father, you know, struggling with a certain amount of lifelong self-doubt and kind of agonizing over his ability to parent well two very, very different children.
Thank you. Yes, I've read the book and it is very funny as well. I just want to say that there's a lot of good humor in there, which I really appreciate.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. It was very, very fun to read. So, but just wanted to say
the world does not need that many more very earnest travel books by middle-aged white guys. I figured there had to be some humor in there.
Yeah, no.
There had to be some not taking yourself too seriously in there. So.
Yeah. So just, I was going to ask about, your writing process, but since we're talking about what you discussed in the book about living in France,
yeah.
Would you say, I mean, so I spent a semester in Paris when I was in college, like 20 mm-hmm. years ago. So, and it was a very awesome, but eye-opening experience. So if you, just because I think people might be curious about an American living, you know, over and especially in such a small village. Do you have, what's your biggest takeaway that you would have, that you would say you had from that experience?
Well, it would be hard to pick one, but if I had to pick one, I would say, based on your question, my answer would be that what we learned in that experience was the extent to which travel as an industry has really ceased to be all that interesting, but travel is still really interesting if you go a very few places and stay there a long time, if that makes sense.
Yes, definitely.
So it's less travel at that point than it is essentially, you know, investing yourself in a place and trusting that if you invest yourself in almost any place, there are going to be enormous rewards. And in some sense, even though it feels limited and maybe even a little bit boring, the rich rewards of going deep into a place and with the people of that place who know it well really end up outweighing or out enriching the usual experience of travel, which is so, it's so hard to get outside the gravitational pull of tourist experiences because that industry has gotten so good at presenting you with them. So I think that would be the biggest takeaway is what we refer to it as going narrow and deep. So fewer places, staying longer, going deeper.
I like that a lot. It makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, if you just go and stay for like a few days in a place, you're not going to learn that much about it.
But you're going to see a lot of the inside of airports and hotels, but you know, you're not going to have a world change. You're not going to have a life-changing experience if that's what you're after. And really, in some sense, you may not even have a life-enriching experience because what you can access in that small amount of time is usually what a million other people have already seen.
True. Yes. So in your bio and your book, you discuss the gradual acceptance of you and your family by the residents of that village. What were some lessons that you could offer, just since we're on this topic, what are some lessons you could offer our non-French listeners who decide to go abroad and live in France?
In France, Well, it certainly helps to at least try with the language. I would say that there, you know, the French have an unearned reputation for being prickly and impatient. And I don't think that is entirely fair. It is in some places, but often it's true in those places that are overrun with tourists and often American tourists who aren't making any effort whatsoever to speak any French. So I think trying it all is job one. But I would also really say that I think it's important to understand that France is not France. It's not monolithic. There is no France. I mean, there kind of is in the same way that there is an America, which is also made up of, you know, regions and states that are very different from each other. But in terms of really experiencing it, I think looking at France as a collection of regions and then finding the region that has the things that you want to experience would be a way of starting to try to enter into this place that's so full of mystique, but also has so many different facets to it that they can start to feel overwhelming. But you know, if you go to the north in Normandy and you really like cheese and butter and apples, that's where you should go. If you want a world capital, you should go to Paris. If you want, you know, a gritty Mediterranean experience, but that is incredibly diverse, you should, you know, and you're not afraid of a little whiff of danger, you should go to Marseille. If you want to ski, you should go to the Pyrenees or the Alps. You know what I mean? There's like,
yes, there's a
research,
lot
doing a little bit of research about what these different regions offer in terms of food, experiences, the types of people who inhabit those places and what their history's been. That would be my first kind of way to seek a door of entry into the country.
Thank you. That's really helpful. And then, so I just want to pivot back to the book. So it's your first book.
Yeah.
Just since we have a lot of listeners who are writers as well, could you just talk a little about your process of writing the book and editing it? And I guess just like, you know, takeaways from that, but also challenges you ran into, things you wouldn't do again, that kind of thing, you know?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I could talk the rest of the night about that.
Yes,
but
I'm sure.
I'll try to keep it at least interesting, if not short. So it took me 10 years to write the book. So the experience happened in 2012 and the book was more or less finished in 2022 and was published this year in 2024. And I felt as if I were the only one at the time, and now I don't believe that anymore, but I felt as if I were the only one who was both learning how to write a book and trying to write a book at the same time. But I was doing that. And I think in retrospect, and based on my subsequent experiences, that most writers are doing that. And that I feel like maybe one initial piece of advice is to not judge yourself too harshly about that feeling, that we're all operating at the edges of our capacities and we're also learning our craft at the same time. And you just get incrementally better as you continue to take that seriously. But the other thing, so I had several turning points in the writing process. There was the book initially arose out of a series of journal entries. I kept about 110,000 words worth of journal entries in while we were there. And then I did go back a couple of other times to kind of enrich some descriptions of some of the places that featured in the book. But the heart of the book was a journal. And my love of writing and books and words came very early, but I was always in love with the kind of glittering surface language of great writers. So I love writers like Nabokov and John Updike and Annie Proulx and Jane Austen, who could just enchant you with the surface of their writing, whether or not you even like the story.
Yeah.
And that was the kind of writing that I liked to do and started to do in the early part of this book. And I would say the biggest turning point, and this is for me as an author, and I think other authors would have a different experience, but I think it is also somewhat universal. I reached a point about 7 years in where I thought I was very close to being done with this book. And I had a writing coach say, "Steve, you're a beautiful writer, but nobody cares." Not a message you want to hear at that point in the process.
Oh my God.
It was the turning point. It was the rock bottom moment that made me understand that I had to be open to new ideas, that I couldn't keep trying to write my way out of the problem that this book had, the fact that it was slightly underconceived. And the reasoning that she gave me why nobody cared is that I wasn't letting people in. I wasn't letting the reader in. I wasn't trusting that the reader wanted to get to know who I was.
Oh, yeah.
I felt that was exactly what they didn't want. They wanted me to entertain them and charm them and make them laugh. But the last thing they wanted to do was to get to know me. and ultimately internalizing that and accepting it, and then getting to the point where I could write like that. I could invite the reader in. I could be vulnerable. I could write in a way that said that I didn't have all the answers. That was what turned it from being a sort of charming but very light travelogue to what I believe it turned into. And I guess I hope you agree, but it really is a true memoir at this point. There's an emotional richness. There's a relationship richness to the telling of the story and to the sense that the reader gets that they've actually been through something kind of, if not important, at least engrossing and rich by the time they're done. That all came very late in the process, and it came from that understanding.
Yeah, that must have been hard to hear, but it sounds like it was very worth it. So
yeah, I mean, sometimes people need to call bullshit on you, right? And that was a calling bullshit moment. And the interesting thing is that my wife, Mary Jo, who you know as well as most people now, having read the book, is also a truth teller, right? She's kind of the hero of the book in many ways because she's willing to tell me the truth. And that can come off as just sort of pecking at me from one perspective, but really that takes a lot of courage as well to believe that, to be willing to challenge somebody you're very close to as long as it takes to get them to be the better person that they really actually want to be, but they can't get over themselves for the time being. And so I've been hearing that message from Mary Jo, but it's often very much harder to accept a message from your spouse. Sometimes you have to hear it from somebody else. Sure. So, yeah.
And just to touch on the experience with the writing coach. So where did you connect with that coach? How did you find her?
I found her because she had written a book on writing. And I emailed her and asked if she did any individual instruction, individual work with writers.
Yeah.
She was one of several coaches that I worked with. Again, and I learned a little bit each time. And that was also this process of starting without really knowing what it meant to put a book together and ending finally having a book put together. So, but yeah, it was that. The other really important step that I took, again, in my own path as a writer and in my own path of writing this book, was after she said that, I knew I had to include some more vulnerability. I needed to be in process on the page as part of moving from somebody who was imperfect to somebody who was, you know, less imperfect by the end of the book. But the other thing that I did, again, because I was so hung up on beautiful writing that I realized at some point that I wasn't telling a story and I didn't even really understand entirely what a story was.
Yeah.
So I ended up taking a screenwriting class.
Oh, cool.
And what that did for me is kind of set off to one side the fact that it didn't matter for a while whether I could describe that meal of, you know, of mackerel grilled over vine wood beautifully and immersively and compellingly. None of that mattered. What mattered in a screenplay was, do you care about these characters? Do you want to know what happens next? There's a compactness and a forward sort of propulsion that happens in screenwriting that I needed to learn for myself. And that also really helped it move from being a little bit of a wandering travelogue to being a much tighter narrative with somebody who wants something and is encountering opposition and is ultimately faced with a dilemma. And so that, and again, for some people, you know, I think there are a lot of intuitive writers who tend to write, you know, their descriptions, their dialogue, their characters are all really strong, but they have trouble with plot and story and structure. And then I think there are a lot of conceptual writers who just love all that. They've got their entire thing mapped out, but their dialogue is wooden, or their characters aren't believable, or they're not engaged emotionally. And so I was very much an intuitive writer, and I needed that to learn structure. But there may be a very conceptual writer who needs to read more poetry, for instance, and who, you know, needs to immerse in the beauty of language and in the idea that words are often richer when they're doing two things at once, and when they're very, very precise in the way that poetry is.
That's great. Thank you. It's really interesting. I also used to write, and I'm thinking about starting again. So I also always had a hard time with the storytelling part. So
this has been really
inspiring for me. So thank you.
And I think honestly, most writers are introverts. And I think that introverts tend to be turned off by sales pitches. because they involve negotiation and dealing with other people in a way that's not just comfortable. And so, and I think a lot of introverts think of structure and story as a kind of sales pitch. Like it's too cheap. It's too Hollywood. It's too manipulated. It's too
well packaged. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, but what often happens is that they avoid it so much that there's just simply no movement in their story. There's no, the reader just doesn't care. It's this happened, then that happened, then that happened, but not with that forward narrative momentum that you need to keep a reader. And so at some point you have to give a reader that. They you know, even the most esoteric reader, I think at some point wants some of that.
Yes.
And it's important to get over yourself and realize that you got to give them a little bit of Hollywood, you know, even if it's just a touch.
Yeah. So let's see, would you ever write another book? Are you thinking about doing that? Or was this, kind of
absolutely, work? Absolutely.
Yes. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like I did all the work. I mean, I've dreamed about it being a writer since I was a boy.
Yeah, that's awesome.
I grew up in a fairly literary family and I had a bunch of uncles that I kind of worshiped. I worshiped authors and writers from very early on. I studied languages and literature in college. It was really just in the middle of my life, you know, that didn't prep me to make any kind of money in 21st century America. So I ended up becoming a real estate agent and a tax preparer as a way of paying the bills. But this experience of writing the book was really returning to a very early and very deep love. And the fact that I feel as if I now have the tools to actually write more than one book kind of thrills me. And I can't wait to get back to whatever the next book might be.
Do you have any ideas on possible topics for the book or?
Yeah, I do. I'm interested in a number of things. Unfortunately, one of them is that we just had a house fire.
Oh, no. Why you're in your son's?
That is correct. Yes.
Oh, my God. I'm so sorry to hear that.
Thank you. Yeah. And so, I'm not here asking for sympathy, but it's been obviously enormously disruptive. It happened on October 4th. But what it has done is, you know, in the middle of the devastation, there's something very clarifying about that kind of disaster, right? Always. Mm-hmm. And so it's too early. I'm not beyond just the sheer kind of raw feelings of it, but I can see already ways in which that's going to be clarifying. It took some things away, but some of those things that it took away were things I was going to have to literally just some of the things, the physical things were items that I was going to have to make agonizing decisions about in the future. Yeah. But additionally, as somebody who's very obsessed with place and place as a, you know, this book is very much about how this place changed me, right? This tiny little village unexpectedly turned me from one kind of person into a different kind of person by the time we had left. So as somebody obsessed with place or very interested in place and identity, I think the fact that I don't have a home right now, that I don't have a place, brings up all kinds of interesting questions about who I am and what's important and what are the minimum number of things that you need to live graciously. I think those are all questions I've always been interested in now, and now suddenly they're extremely acute and urgent. So I can imagine actually writing about this as a next book. It just brings up so many kind of universal themes.
Great. Yeah. I mean, I'm sorry about the fire, but I can imagine that I can definitely relate with the amount of things that just follow you wherever you go, and then you're going to just have them till the end.
Correct. And you love them, you know, there's a reason that you're keeping them, and yet you know that they're weighing you down in a way.
Yeah.
And so my wife and I have been very interested in kind of Scandinavian and Japanese minimalism as well. Yeah. But more than that, it's minimalism more as a way of asking, like, if you're going to try to almost turn the way that you live into a work of art over and above whatever creative works you do, then everything matters. Everything that you bring into your house, everything that you bring into your life matters, because there's an art and creativity thread and there's a living thread. And at some point you're trying to twine them into one thing. And so this event is really going to make us reconsider or think very deeply about what matters, who are we, what do we bring back into our life at this point?
Cool. So you published with Penguin, right? Was it?
With Crown, right? Crown is that imprint of Penguin Random House. Yeah. Yes, exactly. Okay. Yep.
So when you do write another book, mm-hmm. which sounds really exciting. Would you be trying to publish with them again, or would you consider self-publishing? Or
I don't think I would consider self-publishing. I've been thrilled with Crown. They've been really great. But I also work with an agent. So I think it would ultimately be a question of where he thought he could sell the book. Okay. But, you know, the question of self-publishing is really interesting. Obviously, it's a big thing and it's a growing kind of sector. Mm-hmm. I for me personally, I still feel as if there's an important gatekeeping function of traditional publishing. Yes. I really think, you know, again, I spent all those years thinking that I was a beautiful writer and being a little bit mad at the industry for not recognizing my genius. But in retrospect, they were right. My book was underconceived. It was not yet a completed project. Yeah. And I think if I had self-published, I would be happy enough, but I wouldn't have gone through all the steps that it take to make this truly finished. And that would concern me, that self-publishing is in some ways a little bit of stepping off the train before it reaches the station.
Yeah, that's really great. That's because I mean, I feel like there are people who've had success with self-publishing, but
enormous success.
Enormous, yeah. But I really hear what you're saying about the gatekeeping thing, which is something I have thought about a little bit, but not really explored.
And the other one, just one other quick thing on that topic. Sure. The other thing that the traditional publishers are doing for you without you really knowing it until you publish the book is they're vetting your book for whether it's going to sell or not. And they already know,
that's
right?
True. Yes.
That's what they do best is sell books. And if they're telling you this book isn't going to sell, a lot of people hate that message. But if you go self-publish, you know, I'm learning right now what's involved in marketing and publicity, and it's an enormous job. It is an endless job. It's going to take all, you know, as much time, not as much time, but it's going to take a year of constant effort to do marketing, the book justice on marketing and publicity. And so in some sense, the traditional publishers are doing you a bit of a favor by guiding you towards something that they believe is going to sell.
That's a really good point. And it sounds like you just learned a lot from having to go through that experience with the coach, where you realized, you know, the language was your passion, but then you realized that, no, we need some more plot kind of going on. And
exactly.
Story.
Very much so.
Yeah.
And yeah. With several coaches in succession, honestly, I ended up, you know, I just kept the one thing that I did right. I feel like I did all kinds of things wrong. The one thing I did right is I was so freaking stubborn. There was so much sunk cost.
Good,
at
that's
some point.
Important.
I was not going to give up. I was not going to not get this book across the finish line.
That's
one
great.
Way or the other. I was going to win ugly if I had to. And so I did. I tried everything. And I, you know, I tried editors. I tried private coaches. I tried readers. I did paid readers and got feedback. I really tried everything that I could possibly think of. And I think I learned a little bit along each step. But that, you know, maybe that's one other message is, honestly, it's a very long, very difficult process. And you got to be all in. You cannot be half-hearted.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then I just wanted to mention, so you were honored with the 2019 James Beard MFK Fisher Distinguished Writing Award and other awards. Can you just tell us a little about the other ones that you received?
Yeah, so I was a food writer. Again, my food writing career really began with this trip, again, with that journal that I talked about. Those episodes, several of them turned into short pieces that I wrote for the Minneapolis Star Tribune. And those articles won a food writing award the first year. And that was actually the impetus to write the book. Is that, okay, I'm going to New York City. I'm going to be at an award ceremony. I should probably have a book proposal just in case. Yeah. So, but the other awards were one was the Association of Food Journalists, which is now a defunct organization, but those were primarily like newspaper food editors, very traditional old school journalism. I won a number of awards with them over the years. The other one is the IACP, which is the International Association of Culinary Professionals. Oh. They give out annual awards, both similar to the James Beard Award. So it goes both to food writers, food media people, cookbook authors. And so I won several awards with them as well. And then the big one, the sort of the Oscars of the food writing world is James Beard. And that was a difference making award. That was, you know, I'd been querying agents and trying to get my book in front of people. And literally in New York City at that award ceremony, I met Francis Lamb, who ended up being my editor. And he pointed out a guy walking across the room and said, if you don't have an agent, that should be your agent. And that was David Black, who became my agent. So in about 15 minutes after, you know, many years trying to work this opaque, difficult system. Winning that award got me an editor and an agent within a half an hour.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. So if someone were to, other than the book, obviously, with your food writing, where should someone, what's the piece that you wrote that you've written over the years that you're the most proud of as far as the...
Yeah, I would say that it was the one that won that, the James Beard Award. Yeah. it's called What is Northern Food? Okay. And it was an attempt to reckon with, I've done a lot of writing about French food, French Mediterranean food, French food and wine. Just because of my, you know, my Francophilia and my, and the fact that I've spoken French for most of my adult life. Mm-hmm. But the What is Northern Food was a really deep dive into the food of the Great Lakes North.
Okay.
Which I tried to differentiate from Midwestern food, which is its own thing, but which I also tried really hard to reinvigorate in a way, because I think it gets bogged down by the assumption that it's mostly, Eastern or Central European comfort food. It's, you know, brought in by Scandinavians or Germans or, you know, Czechs or whatever. And to start thinking about what is our food, quote unquote, as being what, you know, in the Twin Cities, the Hmong population has brought in, the Latino population has brought in, what, you know, we have a very strong rediscovery of indigenous foods of the region as well, with a couple of chefs who are doing incredible work. And so it was sort of, let's respect tradition, but let's also understand that we're in the midst of having new traditions being established right under our feet.
Yeah.
And these are also our foods. These aren't somebody else's food. This is our food.
Okay. Yeah. I'm definitely going to look that up. And just to follow up on that, the chefs that you just mentioned, could you name a couple names possibly?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. The one who's probably the most influential is named Sean Sherman, S-E-A-N, Sean okay. Sherman. He also goes by the moniker, the Sioux Chef, but Sioux is spelled S-I-O-U-X. And he's written an entire cookbook about of the ingredients of pre-Columbian native North American ingredients. And he has also opened a restaurant in downtown Minneapolis, right in the Mississippi River, that attempts to put that idea into practice. So he's only serving food that would have existed in North America, North and South America, really in the Americas, but primarily North America prior to Western arrival. And it's super exciting.
It
can sound maybe limiting, but you know, you start looking at the ingredients that are available, and it's, you know, it's freshwater fish, it's trout, it's it's wild turkey, it's venison, it's Jerusalem artichokes, it's, you know, it's maple syrup, it's black walnuts. I mean, there's an incredible variety of native foods that were here before Westerners arrived. And it can be frustrating to eat as an American because it's gotten so genericized lately. This is a way of saying, wait a minute, we actually do have a deep tradition. It didn't all just start when Europeans set foot on our soil. And so I find it thrilling. I could talk all day about that as well.
So which city is he working in?
In Minneapolis.
Yep. Minneapolis. Okay.
Yep. Yep.
If I'm in Minneapolis, I will look it up. I'm on the East Coast. I usually stay over here, but
sure. I couldn't recommend it highly enough. Yeah.
Cool.
In fact, if you come to Minneapolis, the first thing you should do is email me and I will.
Okay. Yes. Yes.
I will serve as your guide.
I think I have friends who are visiting, but if I'll touch base if they end up visiting.
Please do. Yeah. I would love it.
Okay. Let's see. So I did have this kind of question, but you already answered it sort of, but what your next step is as a writer and an author. And it sounds like you're going to just kind of keep moving ahead with the publishing, writing process mm-hmm. first and then publishing.
Right. I think the one refinement I place on that statement is that part of what happened with this book is, again, I taught myself how to be a storyteller, how to tell stories.
Yeah.
And that is suddenly broadens the subjects that I feel like I could tackle. So that I've been a food writer for 12 years, but I feel as if I can start thinking of myself as a writer primarily, who will always be interested in food, and food will probably be a part of almost anything I would write, but that I'm a writer first and a food writer second. I think that shift happened in the last couple of years.
That's great. That, I mean, it sounds like you were really doing some self-exploration, and you got a lot out. I mean, obviously you got a lot out of visiting France for an extended period, but then writing the book as well over 10 years. So,
yeah, I mean, there's a point in the process that I refer to as, the point at which, and this is post, Steve, you're a beautiful writer, but nobody cares. Part of the lesson I took away from that is that I had been trying to get this book published by being a better and better writer, and by focusing it more and more intensively on my ability to put things into words. And there came a point where I felt I understood that I didn't have to be a better writer. I needed to be sort of a better human being, or at least a more self-aware human being, in order to continue to be a writer. And that will translate and be helpful, I think, for the rest of my career.
Yeah. Because it sounds so, the first coach that you mentioned said that you weren't being vulnerable enough.
I wasn't trusting that people wanted to get to know me.
That makes a lot of sense. I've never really thought about that, but I've also struggled with that too. It's like, right? Why do they care, you know?
Exactly. I mean, just
gotta
this
make
guy.
Them care, you know?
Right. Except that if you think about it, every story you've ever gotten interested in is somebody letting you in, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we're all fascinated with other people. We all wonder, we have these walls up around us, and we wonder how other people think and how they get by and how they live their lives and, who they have sex with and how they eat breakfast and all this stuff. We're fascinated with people. And that was a real shift to think, okay, well, I have this weird story, everybody has a weird story. And it was sort of almost embracing your weirdness, but weirdness as being all of the irreplaceable things that experiences you've had that led up to this moment. And if you add those all up, that makes you somebody that is unlike anybody else, even if you seem normal and uninteresting to yourself.
Right. Well, one more question of anything else you'd just like to share with our listeners about the writing process or your future plans or anything pretty much.
Well, before I'm done, I'll just point to my website, which is where you can order my book and also see all my other published writing is there.
Oh, cool.
So that's just www.sjrhoffman.com.
Okay.
Stephen John Raymond Hoffman.com. Yeah. But in terms of advice or sort of thoughts for sort of closing thoughts, and you said this audience is more heavily made up with writers, probably with
writers. With are... So it's called the journalist was called Talking Writing. Now we're mainly a podcast, but there's a lot of writers, some artists, creatives.
Yeah. I really think my emphasis would be what we were just talking about. I think embracing your unique weirdness is really important.
Yeah.
I think because here's maybe a way of going a step further with that, because really all great writing happens in specificity, right? Mm-hmm. It happens in extreme specifics. I mean, if you think about a great novel that you've read or a great piece of poetry, there, yes, universal themes arise, but the story itself is always based in really specific people, situations, backgrounds, experiences, conflicts. They're all specific. And so I just feel as if our weirdness, our uniqueness is the kind of specifics that people are interested in and focusing focusing on what kind of, who you are irreplaceably. The one other thing maybe I would say, and you can tell me if I'm going on too long, but one other thing I think I would say is there's a concept that the screenwriting coach I work with talks about, which he calls your heart of darkness. And that is that thing about yourself that you don't want to believe is true, or the thing that you most want to imagine is true, or the thing that you can't imagine ever losing or can't imagine experiencing or could never imagine giving up as a relationship or as a part of yourself. Those are sort of writing into those places or writing out of those places automatically makes you vulnerable. It automatically makes you somebody who's struggling. And when you're struggling on the page, people are interested. Their ears perk up. They immediately empathize with you.
Yeah.
If you're showing yourself in struggle, if you're showing yourself tackling your demons, I think that's always interesting. And that leads to the kind of writing where people read is on this page and they want to know what happens on the next page.
Okay. This has been great. Thank you. I really enjoyed this. I did too.
Any
other questions. So, but I'll follow up with an email if I need to clarify anything.
I'd be happy to answer anything.
If I'm in Minneapolis, I will definitely look you up.
I can't recommend it highly enough. Okay, Jess.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate
Thanks a bunch.
The time.
I appreciate it too. Okay. Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Writing Podcast. We're an independent literary site and nonprofit organization based in the Boston area, but with contributors from around the world. Since our founding in 2010, we've relied on donations to keep publishing and podcasting. To donate to TW, you can use the donate button on the rss.com page of this podcast or visit talkingwriting.com/donate. And of course, feel free to drop us a line at editor@talkingwriting.com.